Curious to hear if emergency management has anything to weigh in on.
So to find the boards that someone asked me, where do we find the boards and committees page? To find the boards and committees page, go to the homepage, the county homepage, to government, to boards and commissions, and then board and commission vacancies. When they click on the vacancy, it goes to that board's page for specific information about that board. So anyway, or call us at 360-385-9100 and we can help you navigate to that page. Okay, it's 9:45 and I see we have Dr. Barry and Willie Bentz with us. Are we gonna, you wanna start off this morning, Willie? Shake things up a little bit?
Yeah, sure. I don't mind. I'll try not to take too much time. I have a lot of practice at keeping it relatively brief, but no updates from the COVID front, but as Commissioner Dean mentioned, we had a little bit of an interesting day yesterday with a short period of extremely heavy rain, led to a small landslide out on Water Street, as well as a closure of Water Street. I know our grocery stores were closed for a brief period of time due to the flooding in their parking lots that was seeping into their stores. And so really for me, just a reminder to folks that when you see flood water like that, I think folks generally underestimate the danger involved in driving in any sort of flood water. So it's always best when you see any extreme flooding like that, anything over 6 inches to a foot, turn around, find an alternate route. Do subscribe to our Nixle text alert system. We had sent out alerts that Water Street was closed. That's how we were able to push that information out. I'm allowing folks to divert any potential trips into the area. So you can subscribe to that through our website or by texting Jeffco DEM to 888-777. This was an interesting incident because it was over such a short period of time. There were some thunderstorm systems that were moving throughout the Pacific Northwest. And with those systems, they bring really short, heavy, intense periods of rain. So this flooding was a result of a stormwater system that was overwhelmed by the sheer volume of water in such a short period of time. So I do have to give a ton of credit to the city of Port Townsend, who was able to resolve the issue so quickly. I was really surprised and to see these streets were closed for just a handful of hours. I know, for example, the co-op was closed and then was able to reopen just a few hours later. We've gotten reports of a number of folks in the city whose basements flooded specifically. So if folks have questions or concerns about that, I'm more than happy to chat with them, reach out to us. Someone did ask about the possibility of emergency assistance. FEMA does have a program for individual assistance for federally declared disasters. We're not pursuing a declaration for this event. We've actually never had an individual assistance declaration from FEMA here in this county in our history. So this unfortunately certainly won't meet that threshold, but if you have questions about navigating the cleanup, and the insurance process, what have you, do not hesitate to give us a call. Even just a little bit of flood water down in your basement can lead to long-term mold, mildew issues. I know certainly some folks, one of my neighbors, for example, had his book collection in his basement, concerned about the, some sentimental issues there, as well as just the value of some of those. So the cleanup process can be a little bit difficult for him. So give us a call. I'm glad everyone was able to stay safe. And again, huge credit to the city of PT for clearing it so quickly and reopening our streets. Other than that, that's the end of my report.
Thanks, I have one Willie. Question for you, Willie. Oh, sorry. We had a public comment again today about extreme weather shelters. And I'm just wondering if you could just give us a quick update about those conversations.
Yeah, so as I said, just a couple of weeks ago, we're pulling together a meeting later this month where we'll be talking with some of our partners as we put our plan together. So no real update from, I think I talked about this just a week or two back. So no major update there other than we are making progress on that plan. And as I mentioned last week, just like with this weather event yesterday, this is something new for a lot of jurisdictions across the state of Washington. So we're putting together our first severe weather shelter plan. which will include warming centers for cold weather, cooling centers for warm weather, and then clean air shelters for when we experience one of the smoke events that we did summer ago. So that plan is nearing completion. We'll have a gathering here later this month, and then we'll have everything ready for a warmer winter season later this summer. We are on track for a continued cool and wet June, thankfully, but we are expecting the current climate predictions show a warmer August and September. So that's what we're really prepping for this year.
Thanks, Willie.
And maybe just worth noting, as Willie is glad to see that you're going to be talking about some of these topics to the Chamber Cafe on the 17th. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. And so we'll be talking about business continuity and preparedness. I'll be talking a little bit of about our COVID response and some kind of initial lessons learned there. So always, it's been about a year and a half since I was able to talk to the Chamber at one of their cafes. So excited to be back there. And we will touch a little bit on severe weather preparedness, among other things. Absolutely.
Are we going to have the picnic this year? I always call it the yo-yo picnic, but...
We are going to have the all county picnic. The yo-yo picnic is an appropriate name. And for the uninitiated, yo-yo stands for you're on your own, which I hate to say, but we are honest here in the Department of Emergency Management that after a catastrophic disaster, you know, catastrophic disasters by their very nature overwhelm local resources. Never mind the fact that we are human beings too, and we will be affected by the disaster as well. So we message that you're going to be on your own potentially for an extended period of time. So the All County Picnic is designed to promote disaster resilience, bring the community together to talk about issues related to disaster preparedness, build relationships before the disaster, et cetera. It's been held every August for just about 10 years now. It looked a little bit different during COVID, where we've had some virtual picnics in place, as we called them. We will have a picnic this year. We will still encourage folks, if that's what they're more inclined to do, to picnic in place, to picnic in small groups outdoors. But we will have an in-person event just on a little bit of a smaller scale coming up this August. So absolutely, we're excited for that. Still be a little bit of a modified form, but it's our 10th anniversary of the All County. So we'll absolutely be having an event this year.
Great.
Thanks, Willie. Dr. Berry, are you ready to join us now and give your update? She might be in a traffic scene situation, right?
Star six to unmute.
Hi there. Yes, I am happy to join you all. I am en route to a conference of the local public health officials in Washington State, so that's why I'm joining by phone. But it's my pleasure to be here. Hopefully the audio is okay. So looking at the COVID-19 situation nationally, cases are plateauing at the national level and actually decreasing in the Northeast, which was hit first by the pandemic. Hospitalizations are still rising nationally, but relatively slowly, up 16% in the last 2 weeks. Deaths are actually downtrending nationally. They're at one of the lowest rates that we've seen in the pandemic. We're seeing 267 deaths per day, which of course is still much more than we see in an average flu season. And we unfortunately have passed the threshold of losing more than a million Americans to COVID-19, which puts us at one of the highest death rates due to COVID-19 in the world. In Washington State, we are seeing cases plateauing as well. In Jefferson, we are seeing cases plateauing. Our current cases are up to 4,211 with a case rate of 823 with a percent positivity of 18%. We have no one currently hospitalized for COVID-19 for a total of 131 hospitalizations and no new deaths. So 29 deaths due to COVID-19 in our county. In Clallam County, case rates are actually starting to decrease already. We're up to 12,843 cases with a case rate of 650 per 100,000 and an 18% positivity. We have three people currently hospitalized for COVID-19 for a total of 376 hospitalizations and 112 deaths. So at this point, case rates are still incredibly high. We are seeing quite a bit of transmission in our community. But one very hopeful thing is we really have not seen a surge in hospitalizations in this round. This is really the first time we've seen that, and we have been at very high rates of transmission for quite some time. It's interesting that we are seeing a very somewhat different pattern than what we're seeing in the rest of the country. Much of the rest of the country has experienced a surge in hospitalizations. The Northeast, the South, the Midwest got really hit hard by a surge in hospitalizations. But in Jefferson and Clallam County, we really have not seen that. And that is most likely due to the very high rates of vaccination we have in our communities. Jefferson, of course, has a higher vaccination rate than Clallam County, but even Clallam County is the fourth highest vaccinated county in the state, and Washington is a well-vaccinated state. We're seeing excellent protection against severe disease in the vaccine, and we think that is one of the biggest drivers of why we're not seeing a hospitalization surge in our region. The other thing that we're seeing is very good uptake of Paxlovid. So our healthcare system has been working incredibly hard to make sure people have access to that medication. And that really seems to be playing a significant role in preventing hospitalization in our region. So I am hopeful that we are moving truly into a more endemic phase of this virus. Now, variants can always throw a wrench in those plans, but so far, we are moving into a more hopeful direction. COVID-19 is still very unpleasant, and there can be significant side effects. You can certainly experience severe disease if you are unvaccinated, but for those who are fully vaccinated and boosted, who've had those three shots, we're really not seeing the level of severe disease that we used to see from this virus, and that's very hopeful. So with that, I'm happy to start with any questions from our commissioners.
Greg or Kate, do you have any questions? Greg, looks like Greg's got his hand raised.
Yeah, did you say the pandemic's over? Are we in an endemic state? How can we tell? What's the threshold that we pass?
I would say it's not over, but right now I do think we are in the process of transitioning to that endemic phase, i.e. we are likely to still see surges in cases, but this is the first time that we've had a surge and not seen a surge in hospitalization and death. So for many of us got COVID in the last couple months. I'm sure you have friends and family and people you know who got COVID. And those cases can still be severe, primarily for those who are unvaccinated and also for those who cannot respond to their vaccine. So those who are immunosuppressed or very, very elderly, severely ill. But the rest of our community really has not been hospitalized when they got COVID, despite their age, despite their underlying conditions. And that really signals a transition in phases for us.
That's great. Great news. And I'm eagerly awaiting the completion of this transition. And I guess my other question was just about masking, which seems like it's all also in a new phase, you know, where we used to really primarily mask to protect those around us. I think we're entering a phase with the availability of, you know, KF94, KN95 masks of masking to protect yourself if you are immunocompromised or if you're going into a large group. I see more people making the choice to wear a mask, and it seems like the motivation is more of your own personal risk analysis more than stopping community spread, because obviously we failed at that. And so I guess I was wondering what you thought about that, if my analysis is accurate about the new phase of masking we're in.
Yeah, I think we are in this transition. Part of what we are moving away from is kind of this mandatory community-wide masking. When we think back to 2 years ago when this was all going on and we didn't have vaccines and COVID-19 could really be a death sentence for a large number of people, we really needed to use more stringent measures to get it under control. But now that we have so many other things at our disposal, we have high-quality vaccines, we have high-quality treatments, we have monoclonal antibodies you can take if you're high risk. Now that we have all these other tools at our disposal, we don't have to be as stringent on those other community level requirements. That said, I do still recommend wearing a mask in indoor settings. I still wear a mask in indoor settings, but we also have access to high quality masks that can go a lot further to protecting you, even if the other people around you aren't wearing a mask. So you can wear a KF94, you can wear a KN95 or an N95 if you could tolerate it, whatever fits best on your face. And those really do work quite well to prevent you from contracting COVID-19.
Great, thank you.
Commissioner Dean.
Yeah, I'd love to ask a follow-up to that. You know, as someone who recently had COVID, in theory, I cannot be reinfected or transmit it for a little while. But I'm very aware of the kind of normative behavior of masking. And so I have chosen to continue wearing a mask in indoor public spaces. And sometimes I think, is this performative and silly, or is there real value to that? So can you speak to you know, sure, the many, many people who have been infected recently and are wondering what's the best way to proceed from a public health perspective?
Sure. So as a person who's recently had COVID-19, if you got infected in this wave and got infected in the last 90 days, you are very unlikely to get COVID again in this next 90 days, particularly if you're vaccinated and then got a breakthrough infection. We are seeing reinfections for unvaccinated folks even as short as 30 days after having COVID. So just having COVID enough is not enough on its own. But if you're vaccinated, had a breakthrough, you can feel relatively confident that you're not going to get it again in the next 90 days and that you're not going to give it to other people. What does this mean about whether or not you mask in indoor settings? I would say for me, part of why I mask is it's a really simple thing I can do to protect the people around me in indoor spaces. It's a thing I can do that can show compassion and care for the other people that are there who are high risk. It can make them feel more comfortable, and it can reduce the risk of me spreading other stuff. You know, I don't like colds, I don't like the flu, and wearing a mask can reduce those things. I think in small group settings, with people who know your status, who know that you recently had COVID, I think it is reasonable to use this time where you're pretty well immune to have some of those gatherings that we've been putting off, because you really are much safer in those spaces. But you want to have that with people who you can talk about the fact that you don't have COVID, so they can understand why you're not masking in those settings.
Thank you. And I do have one more question, if you don't mind, Heidi.
Yeah, of course.
I'm hearing a lot of reports of people testing negative long after they're symptomatic and, you know, 2 to 5 days of pretty severe symptoms and illness, really, before testing positive with the home tests. Is this something that you're hearing, and that is there any data about waning efficacy of home tests at this point? And how should people approach that?
Yes, so this is very common for vaccinated folks, so that you will test negative in the first couple days of your illness. And that's because primarily the thing that is driving all those symptoms that make you feel so bad is your immune system. So it's not actually, you don't have a very high viral load at that point, but your immune system has noticed a little bit of COVID in your body, and it's kicking in, which is good. That means your vaccine is working, but it doesn't feel great when it's happening. The tests still work well. We haven't seen any decreased efficacy of the tests, but what we have seen is really a change in viral dynamics between vaccinated and unvaccinated people. It used to be for unvaccinated folks, and we're still seeing this true with unvaccinated folks, that your viral load shot up most in the days before your symptoms started. Now for our vaccinated folks, what we're seeing is that your symptoms are starting actually before your viral load shoots up, which is really promising, because that really dramatically decreases pre-symptomatic transmission, which was a big part of how COVID-19 spread. So for vaccinated folks, you're actually pretty unlikely to spread it to other people when you're asymptomatic. But once you develop those symptoms, you can. And once you turn positive on that test, you should assume that you have a relatively high viral load and that you really need to isolate. What does that mean practically? Is as a vaccinated person, it's really important to stay home when you're sick. And if you're sick for a couple days, stay home that whole time, even if you're testing negative, and keep testing. So test really 2-3 days in a row. And that can help you know for sure that you're COVID negative and really stay all the way home until your symptoms get better, which has always been good public health policy, but is particularly important right now. If you're nervous and you want to get a PCR, that can sometimes turn positive faster because it has that amplification. But we do think the tests are still really good at determining infectivity, whether or not you have a high enough viral load to infect other people. One other note on testing, I'm also getting a lot of calls, and our office is getting a lot of calls from folks who are still testing positive on day 10. So they've stayed home, they've isolated, and they're continuing to test because we've got antigen tests now, and so they want to be extra safe. We don't think that you are contagious beyond day 10 unless you are immunosuppressed. And so it's really not necessary to keep testing after day 10 in order to leave isolation. But if you're concerned and if you're still testing positive, certainly wearing a mask in indoor settings will reduce the risk that you could transmit any virus to others.
Dr. Berry, to follow up on that, you could still have symptoms but not be transmitting the virus. Is that correct? After day
10? Yes. So lots of people do. Lots of people have a pretty prolonged cough, prolonged fatigue after COVID-19, but we don't see that you're shedding viable virus beyond that 10-day period. So if you still have symptoms, they should be improving. You certainly should be afebrile, not have a fever. But if you don't have a fever, all your symptoms are improving and it's more than day 10, it is okay to leave isolation. But if you're still symptomatic, good idea to keep a mask on. That will make everybody more comfortable around you. And if you have been testing at home and you notice you're still positive, good idea to keep a mask on in those settings too. But we do think you're safe to leave isolation at day 10.
Can I ask one more question?
Okay, go ahead.
I was just worried about the positivity number on testing, that 18% positivity. How does that, I guess, dovetail with all the antigen tests where you don't have a number for how many negative antigen tests there are?
Yeah, so that percent positivity is actually exclusively the Jefferson Healthcare PCRs. So it doesn't include antigen tests at all because of that problem, that we couldn't get a denominator for how many antigen tests are being done out there, how many negatives are not getting reported. And so that's exclusively off PCRs, where we know the total number that are being performed.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And I don't have a question. I just wanted to say that Dr. Berry, I attended the Chamber Awards ceremony a couple of weekends or the weekend before last, and where you were granted the Young Professional of the Year Award. And I loved the quote in the newspaper from Arlene Allen that said, although Berry couldn't be there, she got a massive standing ovation, even though she wasn't there. So we appreciate everything that you have done for our community for the last 2+ years. And I know some people probably in this Zoom room were part of nominating you for both of those awards, the Citizen of the Year and the Young Professional Award. And we just want to call you out and give you a big virtual hug right now. And thank you for all of your care for our community over the last years.
Thank you so much. I did read that and it was really heartening. I was very sad to miss it. I had not taken a vacation for 3 years and I had that already planned when I heard of when the ceremony was going to be. So I decided to stick with it and take that vacation. But it was really lovely to read and I am sorry that I missed it.
Well, all of us who went on your behalf were thrilled to be there representing you, and we're also glad that you were on vacation. So anyway, just wanted to say that publicly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mark, did you have any questions for Dr. Berry?
No, I don't actually. I'm with Commissioner Brotherton, looking forward to completing this transition and moving on at some point.
Yeah. But I know I saw a number of KPTZ questions, so let's turn to the questions from the audience.
Absolutely. So the first question was from someone who had read the Port Townsend Leader article, which quoted Dr. Locke talking about a recent study that basically half of the deaths after vaccines became available were unnecessary. And so this person asked, does that mean that in Jefferson County, we lost about 15 people needlessly? And I would say the number is a little lower than that in Jefferson County because we have such a high vaccination rate. But yes, roughly about half of the deaths after that time period were not necessary, primarily because so many people died who were unvaccinated. And that would have gone an incredibly long way to preventing those deaths. Looking backwards, we can't change things that have passed and we can't bring back the people we've lost. But what we can do is lean on their memory to make the decisions that will protect us going forward. So the biggest thing we all can do to protect ourselves and our neighbors is to get vaccinated. And then if we're going in, into indoor spaces, and particularly high-risk indoor spaces like long-term care facilities, jails and prisons, shelters, places where people are congregating, schools even, wearing masks in those settings really go a long way to reduce transmission and any unnecessary exposure there. This next question says, the newspapers are reporting that Jefferson County has one of the lowest COVID death rates in the nation. Do you think the unique weekly radio podcast allowing KPTZ questions and answers contributed to the good community outcomes? I would say that I think a lot of things contributed to our good outcomes, but certainly the amount of our community who stepped forward to get vaccinated and wear masks made a huge difference. I hope that our KPTZ question and answer sessions have also been helpful. I think navigating the pandemic has been one of the biggest challenges, has been navigating the information landscape and trying to figure out what's real and what's not, and you know, what of what you're seeing in newspapers is too hyped up and what is something you really need to be concerned about. And I think the KPTZ programs have been very helpful at kind of filtering through that noise, so that people can bring their questions directly to us and we can answer them, so that it's possible to navigate the pandemic in an informed way. The next question is about monkeypox. This person was wondering about how much protection they might get from a childhood smallpox immunization against monkeypox. Smallpox vaccination was standard in this country until 1972. So basically, if you were born before about 1971, because it was given at 1 year of life, you likely received a smallpox vaccination. And smallpox vaccines are incredibly effective against monkeypox. They're about 85% effective at preventing monkeypox disease. And it's a really, really good vaccine because what we're seeing is that you maintain high antibody titers against the smallpox virus for decades after you got vaccinated. And so I would say if you were born before 1971, you can consider yourself very low risk for acquiring monkeypox. A good reminder, monkeypox is a very different virus than COVID. It's a concerning sounding virus, but it is much less contagious than COVID. And we have existing vaccines that work very well for it. There so far has been only one positive case of monkeypox in Washington state. There's already been an extensive investigation of contacts in what's called ring vaccination, where we vaccinated all the people who were in close contact with that person. So I do think we'll be able to control monkeypox spread. So I don't think that we need to be concerned about it the way that we're concerned about COVID. But yes, if you were vaccinated for smallpox before 1971, you likely have significant immunity against monkeypox. This next question says that having been double vaccinated and boosted in December of 2021, I'm a healthy person, but I'm struggling to recover from a stubborn case of COVID after 16 days. For the reported COVID cases since the Omicron variant, are there any statistics indicating that it is less likely to get infected as a vaccinated and boosted person compared to those who are unvaccinated? Are the reported symptoms any less severe than those who are unvaccinated? And I would say yes. So you're still 50% less likely to get COVID if you are vaccinated and boosted. It can sometimes not feel like that when we hear about all our friends who are getting COVID, but it is still less likely to get COVID. But most importantly, it is dramatically less likely that you will get severe disease. So you're 17 times less likely to die of COVID if you're vaccinated and boosted, and that's really important. But I think it's important to acknowledge that when we talk about less severe disease, what we mean is you're not hospitalized on a ventilator and that you don't die of it. COVID is still a really significant virus, and I think many people who just contracted COVID in this most recent wave have been surprised by that, by how much it kind of laid them flat. COVID is a very serious virus. So even in breakthrough infections, most people describe some pretty significant symptoms. They feel like they have a very bad flu or that their symptoms can last for quite some time. I would say for those who are vaccinated and boosted, generally those symptoms do improve significantly in the coming weeks. And the rate of severe disease, you know, hospitalization, death is incredibly low. Long COVID can still happen, but the risk of long COVID is much reduced by vaccination as well. So I hope that you get better soon. And if your symptoms aren't improving in the next week, definitely contact your primary care provider to make sure that you're getting the support that you need. This next question asked about something called Deltacron, which is a recombinant of the Delta virus and the Omicron, the Delta variant and the Omicron variant, and if that's circulating in Jefferson County. And it is not. So in order to get what is called Deltacron or this recombinant variant, you need the Delta virus circulating in your community and the Omicron variant of the virus circulating in your community. And for us, Delta stopped circulating in Jefferson County in January of this year. So we are not seeing any Delta infection anymore. So it's not really possible to get novel Delta recombinant with Omicron here. And in the rare cases that we have seen this documented in other countries, it doesn't seem to have a significant transmission advantage. So it dies out pretty much as soon as someone develops it. So I wouldn't be concerned about Deltacron here. This next person drew a parallel that I thought was interesting about the treatments for COVID-19. And they reminded us that our prior president really pushed hydroxychloroquine, and now they're seeing our current president talking about Paxlovid on the TV, and they want to know what the difference is. You know, are these just two different presidents pushing different drugs? And I would say hydroxychloroquine and Paxlovid are very different situations. Hydroxychloroquine was a theoretical potential benefit in the beginning of COVID-19 when we had, you know, this crazy virus and we didn't have any treatments. And so there was a theory tossed out that hydroxychloroquine might help, which was reasonable when we didn't have anything else. But since then, we've had multiple large randomized controlled trials looking at hydroxychloroquine for COVID, and they found that it has no benefit for COVID-19. We have looked at it, we have studied it, and unfortunately, it just didn't work. So there's not any benefit to taking hydroxychloroquine. There is some risk to taking it, so I would not recommend it for COVID-19. It has other medical uses, but COVID-19 is not one of them. Paxlovid, on the other hand, has been extensively studied for COVID-19 and found to be highly effective. So you have an 89% reduction in severe disease for those who are high risk if you take Paxlovid within the first 5 days. So it's a very good drug. It's been well studied, and it makes a big difference if you qualify. So Paxlovid is for anyone who is at risk of severe disease, as long as they're able to access it within the first 5 days. Couple other quick questions. One person asked, why are we seeing a surge in COVID-19 cases in the spring? Is COVID-19 not a seasonal virus? And I would say so far, COVID-19 is not. So far, what we've seen is these recurrent surges of COVID-19, primarily tied to whenever we reduce our mitigation measures. So whenever we take our masks off, we see a subsequent surge in COVID-19. So it's not following a seasonal pattern yet. I think it is likely that it will eventually fall into a seasonal pattern, likely starting around this fall, but not guaranteed. Generally, what makes the flu seasonal is our behavior, is that that's when we come indoors, that's when we travel. What we're seeing right now is our behavior has been all mixed up. by the pandemic. Many of us weren't traveling, and now all of a sudden we are. And that's spreading COVID-19. Many of us weren't gathering, and now we are. And that's spreading COVID-19. It's actually also spreading the flu. So the flu, which is normally a fall and winter virus, is very active right now because we're gathering indoors. So all of these viruses just increase when we gather indoors. But I do think eventually they will move into more of a seasonal pattern. Couple more questions. One person asked, it seems like when people travel, they end up getting COVID and bringing it back. What is driving this? Is this a specific thing in Jefferson County, or is this something that's happening everywhere? And I would say it is happening everywhere. As soon as the FAA and the court ruling got rid of the mask mandate on planes, we saw a dramatic uptick in COVID-19 transmission on planes, as you would expect. I recently was on a plane, and I was one of a handful of people in a high-quality mask on that plane. So we're seeing a ton of COVID-19 transmission related to travel. That is preventable. You can prevent picking up COVID on the plane if you wear a high-quality mask in the airport, in the plane. It is challenging, but it is important, and it makes a big difference. The other big thing that you want to look at is what you do when you arrive. So if you travel to go on a cruise, that's a relatively high-risk interaction. Or if you're traveling to go to a large indoor family gathering, that's relatively high-risk too. So it's just how we're gathering, how we're getting there. That's really what's driving transmission right now. This last person was talking a little bit about what we really started the program with, which is, I hear people saying hospitalizations are increasing, but I don't see that locally. Is it a good sign that even with incredibly high case numbers, we have zero hospitalizations, especially considering our demographic? Yes. So in spite of the fact that we have a relatively elderly population, we continue to not see a surge in hospitalization. And I would say that is driven primarily by the fact that we are very well vaccinated. All of that work that we did as a community to get vaccinated, all of our volunteers coming out to get folks vaccinated, that made a huge difference to protect us from the surges we're seeing in the rest of the country. One thing we're seeing in other parts of the country is that just having a prior infection alone, which is the immunity that much of the rest of the country has, is not enough to prevent severe disease with these most recent variants. But what we have here is vaccination, and that's made a huge difference, as well as the prescription of Paxlovid. So those two things together, I think, are driving the difference we're seeing in our region. And that's all the questions I have.
I saw Greg's hand go up.
Yeah, can I ask one more? Since the pandemic's ending, I guess I know that DEM has already started some after action stuff, and this is really a question for the future, but I'd love to see or get information about any peer-reviewed studies that kind of study the unintended impacts of some of our mitigations. I think that there's a lot of them that have been really strong and some that were sort of misguided at the beginning. And I'm wondering just about social and emotional health, kids' educational progress or lack of progress or regression the last couple of years. And I'm wondering if there's been studies that we can look at and kind of analyze from our own perspective that will help us be, I guess, better prepared or more surgical in our response to any future similar emergencies, which I just feel are inevitable at this point. But I guess I'm just maybe got a little bit of pessimism.
Yeah, I would say there are some studies already starting to come out on this topic, and there will likely be quite a few more. For better or worse, the fact that we've seen very different responses in the country does provide a good basis for research, because we can see how different parts of the country did. I think one interesting thing that we're seeing, particularly in the area of mental health, is that it does really matter, especially pediatric mental health. It does really matter how fast people came back to school. And we came back to school relatively fast in Jefferson County and Clallam County. That was very helpful for our pediatric mental health. The other thing that we've seen is it also really matters how you mitigate the mitigation. So for instance, in Washington State, there was a really intensive effort to by a lot of our schools as well as volunteers to feed children. The fact that we passed federally funding to support some of our most impoverished families actually does seem to have actually been a pretty significant buffer against the severe negative outcomes related to mitigation. But I think it is important to look into this research of, you know, what mitigations, what the downstream effects were. And I think it's also important to look at this research with a critical eye. I think there is a tendency in much of the country to say that basically everything bad that's happening right now is because of COVID mitigations. But if you look very carefully, we're seeing very similar, you know, severe things. Like when we look at things like, you know, some of the worst things that we're talking about right now, like school shootings, we're seeing terrible outcomes in places that had next to no COVID mitigations. But I still see newspapers talking about, you know, maybe this is because of, you know, school shutdowns. But for instance, Texas didn't shut down their schools. And so you always want to look with a critical eye when someone gives you a conclusion without the data to back it up. Really look at what our cause and effect is. And in epidemiology, that is a very challenging thing to find. You can find correlations, but finding causation is a lot more complex, but it can be done. And I think that research will be ongoing for at least the next year.
Great, thank you. I'm just really interested in understanding how, yeah, it's, I guess it's, there's a silver lining in all the different mitigation strategies around the country. And I'd love to gain as much as we can about what worked, what didn't work, and how it can work better next time.
I'll just for add sure. to that real and quick. Go ahead, Dr. Berry.
Oh, I was just going to say one other thing that we do, we are looking at is, you know, how are your mitigation measures communicated really matters. So for instance, very early on in the pandemic, the data was showing that we don't see transmission outside. And yet I still heard communication that the primary goal is to quote unquote stay home. And that's not actually the goal. The goal is don't gather in indoor spaces, which is very different. That means you can meet up outside. That means please do go outside, meet with your friends, get some exercise. And so how we communicate these mitigations is almost as important as what the mitigation is.
And Willie, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, and so as we're starting our response after action process here locally, we are starting to look at some of the studies being done about economic impacts, mental health impacts, et cetera. But I did want to add that, you know, we'll be looking at that over the next months. Obviously, these studies are underway, and I think there's going to be a deluge of them over the course of the next year or so. But this is something that folks are going to be looking at, and we'll still be feeling the impacts of, obviously, 5, 10, 20 years from now. And I use the Hurricane Katrina as a good example of there's still projects underway in New Orleans as part of the rebuild and recovery of that event. And they're still examining long-term economic and human impacts of that particular event. And this was so much more widespread, so many more ripple effects that, you know, honestly, 50 years from now, folks are still going to be looking back and seeing how these impacts played out. So this is a conversation that we'll have, I think, pretty heavily over the next 3 to 6 months, but it's going to be worth revisiting a decade from now. So it'll be something that we'll be definitely keeping an eye on as things come out pretty quickly over the next year, but they'll continue to trickle out and we'll still be feeling these impacts a long while from now.
And I appreciated Dr. Berry talking about the equitable responses and some of the relief, child tax credit and things like that really helped people get through some of that. But I know when you talk about Katrina, I was there, you know, a couple of years after, and there was massive gentrification that resulted as an outpourth of that. And I just want to make sure we're conscious of equity as we look forward and do what we can to mitigate inequity.
No, absolutely. And I think just to add to something that that Willie said as part of this difficulty in parsing cause and effect is there's a tendency, I think, in our dialogue to assume that all the effects that we're seeing are because of the mitigation of the virus. But we also just had a pandemic, which has its own effects. So, for instance, in Katrina, there was very little mitigation, but there was still very significant negative outcomes. And we expect, you know, so right now, it's not just the mitigation effects that we're seeing. It's the effect of living under a pandemic. It's the effect of losing loved ones, losing parents, all of those things. It's the mental health effects of having COVID. All of those things are piling up together. So parsing those is much more complex. So I just want to encourage everyone to, you know, think about it with that critical eye and include the knowledge that living through a pandemic in and of itself, whether we did any mitigations at all, is very, very challenging for our mental health.
Thank you. Oh, Kate.
Do you have time for one more quick question? Dr. Berry, I'm wondering if you can address the, you know, folks are hearing about the rebound effect of Paxlovid. Is that something that should prevent them from seeking that? Just curious if you can help us understand that potential side effect.
Yeah, I think that is being reported in a way that's very confusing and understandable, that people are wondering whether or not they should take this medicine. So Paxlovid does not cause the rebound. The virus itself causes the rebound. So please, if you are at high risk, do still take Paxlovid. What it really means is that when, you know, the most important high risk time for you is those first 5 days when you're taking that medication, and it's really doing the work of preventing you from getting hospitalized, preventing you from dying. But after that, some folks will experience a return of symptoms after they complete their Paxlovid course. And so the most important thing is to stay home when you're sick, and certainly stay home for that full 10 days if you're still feeling sick. You shouldn't leave your isolation early if you are not asymptomatic. So stay home that full 10 days if you're sick. If you have a return of symptoms, we're still not seeing severe disease in those who have been treated. So it's not something to be concerned about. But if you're symptomatic, stay home, wear a mask around others. That's the main takeaway. But do still take Paxlovid if you're high risk. It's very important for reducing severe COVID infection. One last quick thing. I know I promised our director that I would talk about on this call is reminding folks about the Board of Health expansion. It sounds like you guys might have been talking about that when I joined, but just encouraging folks to go to the Jefferson County Public Health website for, we have two open slots. One is for a consumer of public health services, so someone who has utilized our programs, and the other is for a community stakeholder, which is a pretty broad group, those who are invested in our community and who want to serve on the Board of Health. There's a lot more details on the Jefferson County Public Health website, but the deadline for application submission is June 24th. So if you're interested in being on our board and participating in public health decisions, please do apply.
Great PSA. Thank you for that. Okay, well, it's 10:31. I think KPTZ is probably transitioning to some Bob Marley, I hope, right about now. I always love it when I am on KPTZ and some of the music from my childhood comes up. It just sends me right back to being out on the ocean. And anyway, so thanks for being here today, Willie and Dr.